Apologies, we were enjoying French pastries and good conversation.
That's fine. All right, let me know.
All right.
Tour de jour, that's the name of the other place.
Tour de jour. Oh, okay. Anything else I've forgotten here? Turn the lights up. Okay. I think that one needs to be turned off. So welcome, everyone. I will greet the folks in the Cloud Zendo, and then those in the Dirt Zendo will introduce themselves. Oh, those ones are turned up by the remote control now. starting with Jim. Bob. Adine. Welcome back to Portland. Paula.
Paula.
So-on.
So-on.
Brian.
Brian.
Dan.
Dan.
Phil.
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 Mark.
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 Nick.
Nick.
Chris.
Chris.
Melissa.
Melissa.
Paulette.
Paulette.
Henry.
Henry.
And Yeshitsoki?
Yeshitsoki.
Wasn't Betty here?
Betty, yeah, she jumped into the cloud.
Wait a second. I just saw Betty. Okay. Betty and Ruth Ann. And in the Dirt Zendo.
Dave.
Susan.
James.
Katie.
Shoketsu.
All right. Welcome. In terms of announcements, I guess the biggest announcement is the term student program. I should have the dates in front of me in September. 13th? 10th?
Somewhere right in the middle of September.
Somewhere there. There's the term student opens with a retreat on a Saturday, and it's going to end with a closing retreat on a Saturday in November. So this year, it's only a little over 2 months long. And for this period of time, those who sign up for the program attend that opening retreat and that closing retreat, and that opening retreat is a time when we share with one another our life stories and get to know one another. And even if you have done term student before, it's a very fascinating process of just every time you do it, it's like, how is my life story gonna come out this time? It's like, I feel like, you know, if our life is a landscape and our story is like a painting of it. It's just, you know, we might have a different mood, we might have a different take, emphasize something different. And oftentimes over time when we tell our story, it not only changes, but some parts of it, it's actually a healing process. Just telling it and having it held by the group, sometimes we end up just, I mean, I remember certain parts of my life that I would just relate through tears when I first did term student. And then later on, I'd just be like, yeah, I had a pretty happy childhood. I mean, it was like I had told it enough that it wasn't that I would deny that had an impact on me, but just I had healed from a lot of it. So I recommend the program for new folks or for folks who've done it before. The only requirement is that you are a regular participant in some way and are a member. Let's see. And then over that course of that 2 months, you tie that time together with some vows of practice, which are entirely up to you. It can be very specific about how often you're gonna sit, or, you know, a book you're going to read, or a precept you're going to work on, how much you're going to attend Sangha, or it can be something a little more less specific, like I am going to work on, you know, maybe pausing before I speak, or I'm going to work on acceptance of others or something like that. And then the closing retreat, we come back together to just give our account of how the last couple months went. And this not only helps increase the accountability in a way, and we also do some email check-ins in the meantime. That was a really nice part of the program last time. And I always encourage people, if you're going to do it, to just attend that closing retreat, come hell or high water. You know, stuff comes up, sickness, responsibilities, whatever. But like, basically, you show up no matter how you kept your vows, no matter what happened, because that's part of the most important part of the thing, is that we are forming a cohort and doing this together. So showing up and saying, you know, honestly, how things went is all part of the process. So just there's info about it on the website, info about it in our newsletter, and you can just email me, domio@brightwayzen.org, if you are interested. So anything else I should announce, or any questions about any of all of that? So today, today, this is a talk all about altars. So we actually just got a new statue on one of our altars, and I was just thinking, you know, probably there's some people out there probably who just are like, altars, what the heck is up with altars? Some of you may know a lot about it, some of you, I don't know, but I would imagine that even those of you who are familiar with them, have seen them a lot, might not know all that I'm going to share today. So I'm going to start by sharing my screen and showing you a few altars just to get us started. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about altar, you know, why we have them, how to relate to them. And then James is gonna take you on a little tour of our altars in Bright Way. So, and as he shows you the different altars, the four different main altars, I'll be explaining what's on them. So let me share my screen. Back to basic. All right. So here we go. That works all right. Doesn't look like I can scroll through them, but that's okay. I'll just close and open. So this is a fancy, giant, fancy altar in a Japanese monastery. I'm not exactly sure where this is. I think this is Sojiji Soin. And let's see, the next picture, the Buddha image, you have these fancy lantern-y things hanging, you know, in the main area, and then this big, beautiful wooden altars. And usually in monasteries, these altars are so big that there's actually steps on the side so that people can climb up to light the altar, or put fresh flowers on or something. And then let's see, this is a little bit better view of an altar. You can see the Buddha image in the middle, and there's two statues on either side, and candles, flowers and flowers on a table down at the front, and there's an incense burner at the base. And then this is Much simpler. This is the altar at Dharma Rain, where I trained. And this, the altar table itself was specially built. It's in the shape of this Mount Sumeru, which is a, you know, up in the heaven realm. And it's like, so it I don't know how to describe it, right? It goes steps to the middle, gets narrower, and then gets wider. And the main image in the Dharma Rain Zendo is Manjushri. So I'll talk about Manjushri when I show him on our altar. And let's see, I'll wait to describe more about that because we'll be talking about our altars. And then this was our Right Way Zen altar when we were just a city group that met in, that was on a piano bench when we met in a church room not far from here. We would, all of our stuff was in the closet in plastic boxes, and we would pull it out and we set up this little, he lived in the box that he was sitting on. We still have this little Buddha. So this is like kind of your bare minimum altar, right? There's generally some kind of Buddha or Bodhisattva image. There's a candle and flowers. So the candle, as you're looking at the altar, the candle's on the right, flowers are on the left, and usually there's some an incense burner, doesn't have to be in front. So stop that share. So to talk a little bit about, so I'll be showing you more about our altars in a bit, but why Zen altars? I know when I first got into Buddhism, I read about Zazen, I tried Zazen, I started reading about the Four Noble Truths and all that, and I was just like on fire. I'm like, this is what I was looking for. This is great. So in a way, I didn't even, like, I wasn't looking to get involved in a church. I was like, but that the Sangha was the third jewel. So I'm like, okay, I guess I'll go figure out why I'm supposed to hang out with other people. And then similarly, it was like that with altars, which I'm like, I don't know, I suggest maybe that I have an altar. But like many of you, really any of our major monotheistic religions, whether you're talking about Christianity, Judaism, or Islam, like altars that you might bow to or make offerings to with graven images on them is like a little something to get used to. I remember this sense of like, I didn't really know the difference between any kind of Buddha statues at the time. So I got one of those little hotes, which is just, you know, which is just a monk, you know, like the happy monk with the big belly. And I remember putting them up on a little shelf and just being like, that's just, feels wrong. It just feels wrong, but I got used to it. So it's funny that if you were to wander around a Zen temple or a monastery, especially like Japanese monastery, you're going to encounter so many different like statues and characters, you know, these images. So it's not just the Buddha. We have the Bodhisattvas, which I'll talk about, you know, Manjushri, Bodhisattva of Wisdom, Kanzan or Kanon or Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva of Compassion. You could say, well, they're archetypes, but then we have these other characters that come out of nowhere, which aren't exactly Bodhisattvas. They're kind of deities, they're protectors, they're, and we put them on an altar and, you know, so it's like, how on earth did a religion that is non-theistic end up with so many apparent gods, you know, like so many of these images and altars? And the way that this is held in Zen, and this is what I appreciate about belonging to, participating in a real fully fleshed out tradition, is it's not neat. That is really kind of the definition of New Age, It's like you take little pieces and you distill it down to like what you want or what appeals. But when you got a real organic tradition that evolved, it's complicated, it's ambiguous at times, it's got and contains a lot of kind of conflicting messages and stuff like that. So there's many different ways that these characters are held. For me, for example, I do not believe any of them are real. I don't even know that the Buddha was real. I mean, probably. Was he exactly as we describe him? Probably not. I don't know. I don't think he was. If somebody who we might call the Buddha existed, was he some kind of omniscient person? No, I don't think so. I hope not, right? I hope he was just a human being who discovered a spiritual path. So certainly, even in the case of Shakyamuni, it's not like I would want to put him on the altar and worship him or something. It's not. So for me, it is what these different characters symbolize. And, you know, when the Buddha's on the altar, it's symbolizing our potential for our aspiration for awakening and our potential for awakening, our Buddha nature. If Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, is on the altar, you know, in particular, we want to awaken to the emptiness of all things, emptiness, boundarylessness of all things. If Kanseyan or Avalokiteshvara is on the altar, you know, we want to call to mind compassion. I'll be showing you some other characters today that represent other things. So this is, you know, the creation of altars. Well, you know, extends way beyond Buddhism, right? This is like an ancient human thing. Since we humans conceived of anything that they revered or thought had power or anything, what you would take, you would take it, or you would make a representation of it, and you would put it in some kind of special place, usually an elevated place, usually maybe a clean place, and you would decorate that place. So I always like to say, you know, if you feel a little weird about altars, I suggest that maybe you look around your home and notice whether you already have one. Mm-hmm. You know, like you maybe it's your mantelpiece, and that's where you put the pictures of your loved ones, and that's where you put this, you know, something you got from a friend, or, you know, that you it's a special kind of sacred space. So, like I said, I hold these as just as symbols of something that we want to remember or are aspiring to, and they give a focus to our practice. I was trying to imagine, what would a Zendo be like without an altar? Just kind of be like, it wouldn't have a front, you know, it wouldn't have a center of gravity. Whereas, you know, the altar is like, it's reminding us of what we're all there for. And I look at it as a symbol, but there are lots of Buddhists in the world who really believe that these beings exist. And probably a whole spectrum in between, right? All the way from somebody like me who really just kind of sees them as just its symbols. And people all the way to thinking they are like, I can make a prayer to Kanseyan and she will help me. And this is not so out of the, like, this is a different kind of Buddhism. Dogen, who is the father of Soto Zen and who we quote and study and revere, believed that he prayed to Kanseyan on his trip to China in a storm and that she saved them from the storm. So, you know, it's in Buddhism, it's basically like you can hold these beings, these characters, however you want. And sometimes it might make, you know, some folks who are a little weirded out by it, like a little weirded out just to know that like the person next to you might actually be like, I really believe, you know, I believe this is Kanseyan and she has, you know, embodies herself in this statue sometimes, or I don't know. But, you know, we just tolerate the diversity of relationships to it. But you certainly don't have to, you know, feel any kind of sense of like reverence or connection or something like that just because there's a Buddhist being or a statue. And then, you know, we also like bow to altars and make offerings at altars and stuff like that. And then similarly, you know, I find it just, it's a nice ritual of, you know, that kind of focal point of what our aspiration is. So before we go on a little tour, any questions about any of what I've said? All right. All right then, James, start with our main altar. And then, yeah, you're going to pin your video up there.
Yep. Don't worry, you're going to have to look at me. Okay.
Did you?
Oh, yeah. Do we need to have?
You need to spotlight that video. Your James is.
We're co-hosts.
Do you know how to do that?
No.
Okay.
Oh, you speaker?
Yeah.
No. Oh well, could be, but let's because because I'm gonna be talking, so we don't want to do that. We want to spotlight
you. Oh, I've never done that.
Sorry.
Wait, I spotlight. Oh, good. There we go. Okay. A little low res.
Yeah.
Better than nothing.
Okay, so this is our main altar in the Zendo. This is a Buddha statue, obviously. And you can see the flowers and a candle, and then those little dogs are foo dogs. So these are another of the characters, right? They're like protector. You'll see these outside of temples sometimes. And there's a male and a female. They come in pairs, and the male has a little like globe under his paw, and the female has a little cub under her paw. And the idea is like, so, you know, they're from Buddhist and probably beyond Buddhist Chinese mythology, just that they are fierce beings. And many times, I'm not sure about this with foo dogs, but many times these protector deities or beings that are at the gates of temples or on the altars, usually in the stories, they were, you know, not so friendly. They were kind of terrorizing people and scary or whatever. But then they were converted to the Dharma. So it's kind of a nice symbol of like, you know, our fierceness and our energy can be, if it's committed to the right thing, can be beneficial. And then there's an incense burner. And then down below is a little table where there is some, you know, when I go up to the altar during service, this is what I'm doing. On the right, those are little lavender blossoms, and on the left is water, which happens to have a bunch of water lavender blossoms. It says your bandwidth is low, but now you're big again. and we use the lavender instead of powdered incense on charcoal, just because it's very smoky and it can irritate people's lungs. So so we go and you just crush the lavender a little bit and it releases the smell, because what you are offering, so a full altar like the one that we saw in the monastery, you there's several different offerings you put on. You offer light in the form of a candle, you offer, you know, life and beauty in form of the flower, you're offering fragrance not smoke so much. The smoke from the incense doesn't matter. You're offering fragrance, and then you often offer food and water also. So we haven't been bothering with that because, and this is really cute on the, I'll share a link to it, but the Japanese Soto Shu website. So this is like the Japanese like official website for our school of Buddhism. It has a page on Butsudan. This is your home altar. And it tells you about like how to treat your altar and how to set it up. And the thing is you should eat the food that is put on an altar. So like that's so kind of part of the whole neat thing about it, because we put flowering plants on the altar, but a lot of times it's cut flowers. The idea is that these things need to be refreshed, right? So if you visit an altar that is clean and it has fresh flowers and it has a candle that is, you know, hasn't been all burned down, and it has some food and water, people have been there, right? This is a sign that of current devotion, as opposed to like dusty plastic flowers, and you know. But it does take some maintenance, and we're only here twice a week. So, you know, we got enough to do besides like putting food on the altar and then making sure people eat it before we leave. So, so it doesn't have, it's not necessary. How about I just, any questions before we move away from the main altar? And if you're on Katie and the Zendo, and then if you're on Zoom, either raise your hand or unmute yourself, because I can only see so many people. But if you raise your hand or unmute yourself, you'll be shifted so I can see you. So go ahead, Katie.
Do I move here?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just was curious about where you came from. I mean, did somebody go to Visit Us and pick up three Buddha statues, or give them to? Or where did they come from?
That's a great point. This one, thank you for asking,
sure,
was given to me by a dear friend named Bob Orman. And he was somebody that I practiced with at Dharma Rain for a long, long time. And he passed away. He had a long illness. So he knew his end was coming. And he this was his Buddha. And he wanted me to have it. So there, his Buddha is enshrined as our main Buddha. And then I'll as we go to the other ones, I can explain. Okay. So how about we go to, anybody? It doesn't look like anybody in the clouds under. Okay, let's go to Kanzeon. So over here, this is the altar that those of you in the cloud Zendo can kind of see from afar. And this is a beautiful Kanzeon statue that was donated to us by, I wrote it down somewhere, a Japanese woman who, she was getting older. I think she had to downsize and move into, an assisted living place or something like that. And then so she just had her daughter look around online for a Buddhist temple that she could donate it to. And I was like, sure, yeah, all right. So ironically, then she ends up, she's even bigger than our main, Buddha image. But so as many of you know, so we tend to say Kanzeon, but the Bodhisattva of compassion, traditionally in much of the literature is Avalokiteshvara, sometimes portrayed as male, and then Kanon, Kuan Yin, and Kanzeon are all basically names for the same Bodhisattva. So this is the, and the Bodhisattva of compassion, doesn't take a lot of explanation. You might notice there's a picture hanging up on the wall hanging behind her, and there used to be more, so that's Wynn Bruce, who died this year, and there used to be more pictures. I just kind of started over once we came back from lockdown with little pins that I invited people, if somebody has passed away who you want to remember, you can pin their picture up there. So keep that in mind. You're welcome to do that. And if you're in the Cloud Zendo, if you want to, you're welcome to send us a picture. And that's actually, there's a picture in a frame down below of Vicky, who was a member here. And she passed away. So, and that's, it's reflective on the glass, but if you could see, she's kissing my little dog. She was like, my little dog absolutely loved her. So then, basically, because we don't have space for additional altars, there are two other characters on this altar. So that is Udo, who is quite an awesome, he's our new addition. And he is standing on a rock in hell, surrounded by flames. He's got a rope to bind delusions and a sword to cut through them. And he's got a really fierce expression on his face, like snaggle tooth. There's a tooth coming up and a tooth coming down. And this is a Dharmarine. They have, you know, on the main altar, they have Manjushri. On one of the side altars, they have Kanzeon. And then one of the side altars, they have Fudo. And apparently, like, I forget the exact story, but Fudo is, in our lineage, takes the place of another classic character. So traditionally, there would be Shakyamuni there'd be three classic bodhisattvas you'd have enshrined. Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, Kanzeon, the bodhisattva of compassion, and then Samantabhadra, the bodhisattva of loving activity. So Fudo kind of takes the place of Samantabhadra in our lineage's, you know, Buddha halls. Because it's kind of a similar, like, active energy. But one of the things I particularly like about him is that image of fierceness, again, in service to the Dharma. And that, you know, like a reminder that there's a time and a place, you know, because we have this placid Buddha image, and then Manjushri looks very calm and wise, and, you know, and Kanzeon looks very kind. So I like this reminder that sometimes, you know, you gotta stand up for things. And so that's our Fudo. And actually, Dharmarine, we haven't started it here yet, but there is a Fudo service, a Fudo special Fudo chanting service. There's also a special Kanzeon chanting service. And then on the other side is a little Jizo statue that I got from Great Vow. So Jizo is a similar kind of character, as little babies by his, they're such, so cute. So Jizo is similarly a protective deity, but he's a very, like, sweet and accessible one. So this is the bodhisattva character you will see in Japan. You will see all kinds of Jizo statues, all different shapes and sizes, and they will just be like a whole bunch of them in one garden. Out of Great Vow, there's a Jizo garden that has hundreds of Jizo statues in there. And the idea is, like, you might place a Jizo statue, you know, in memory, particularly of children. So Jizo is the bodhisattva of particularly, like, miscarriages and the loss of children. So that's part of what the Jizo garden at Great Bow is. And once a year, they do have a Jizo ceremony where people can go and they, you know, either create a Jizo or they get a statue, and then they make little hats for them. It's so sweet. So Jizo is a very beloved bodhisattva, but also similarly, like, very determined, and will go down into hell to rescue beings. All right, let's go to Manjushri. Any questions about those folks. All right. Okay, so here's our Manjushri. It's kind of dark. Oh, Paulette.
I was wondering, because when I went to Japan, I saw that with all these little statues of babies. And I was wondering what that was. I'm so glad that you explained that.
Yeah, yeah. So the Jesus statues are like, yeah, they're the protector of like women, children, and travelers.
Thank you.
Yeshi.
His other name, Kushida Garba, the or Great Vows, which is why he's another reason why he's up at Great Vow Monastery.
Right, right. So yeah, he's the Bodhisattva of vow of Great Vows. So just like, you know, of wisdom and compassion. And so we say Kushida Garba, Great Vow, that we say that in our meal chant. And that's why Great Vow named itself that. I'm not sure if that's just a low bandwidth thing. Is his image, it's just he's making the picture small just because it says you have low bandwidth.
Yeah.
I don't think it's about how close close it is. So sorry for the picture being small. So yeah, it's a little, you know, the statue's dark, it's a little hard to see the details, but
yeah, that's
there we go. Okay, nice. So I like how this statue is like completely androgynous. It's just like, I don't know, you know, male, female, but it doesn't matter, right? This is about wisdom. So this is a really classic Bodhisattva statue. Bodhisattvas are usually depicted as very, you know, and very ornate, like kind of like royalty almost. And then, yeah, there's a Buddha in the little crown. And then he or she is holding the a nyoi, so it's like a scepter of wisdom, and sitting mostly cross. Well, this is actually the posture of royal ease, so it's not exactly the one at Dharma Rain. Their Manjushri is a monk Manjushri. I looked for one, but I couldn't find one. So it's just then it's just a monk, a bald monk sitting in meditation on top of this beast. So this is, I love the symbology of this is the beast of self. So this is, you know, all of the id, all of the energy, all of the instinct, all of that, you know, if we what we want to do is not kill that self, not to even subdue that self or, you know, get that self under control with reins or something, but to come into a peaceful relationship with that self. That self is in service of something greater. So this Manjushri is sitting in this posture of royal ease, you know, relaxed, but also like can easily get up on this beast of self. Any questions or? Huh?
Where did that one come from?
Oh yeah, this one I did order online.
Oh, you did
order? I did order this one online, and the Fudo as well. And it can take some searching because it's like, I think the Fudo I got on eBay, and this one I might have as well too, because when you just search for this kind of thing, it's not like there's a real like statue store. It'd be nice if there was.
Are those lotuses left and right?
Okay, yes. Yeah, so the flowers on either side are lotus blossoms, and this is the metal ones. I would like those to be. That would be cool. So this is. It's funny because the Japanese like they put these on all of their altars, and in Japan, like it's what's so cool and kind of funny is that the bigger the monastery, the bigger the altar or the temple, and the bigger everything is. So we have like, we have a gong, right? Pretty good sized gong for, I'm lifting it up. So pretty good sized gong in our Zendo. In a really big temple, one of the head temples, like the gong is like the size of a hot tub. And like the thing that hits it has to be on a lever because you can't even lift it up. Everything is huge. So, you know, the statues will be huge and these gold flowers will be absolutely huge and ornate. All right, so how about we go? Yes, so James is actually going to leave the Zendo proper and go back and take you on a little tour. Go back through our tea room. And then this is our Sanzen room, and then a little library. And then up on the top of the library shelf is our founder's altar. So in the center is a Bodhidharma statue, which, come to think of it, now we have two gruff gruff statues. So that's Bodhidharma, is the Zen ancestor who went from India to China and brought, so Buddhism was already in China, but he brought Zen with its meditation. And that, I don't know why he's portrayed as being kind of gruff, but like, you know, similarly, he's just really serious about the Dharma. And then on either side, so this is, I don't know how traditional it is to have Bodhidharma in a, well, because he's kind of like a certain kind of founder, but Dharmarain also has a Bodhidharma in their founder's shrine. So to the right of Bodhidharma is, or to his Bodhi, our right. So on the left there is Kato Chisan. So he would be my Dharma great grandfather. He just looks so sweet. So he's the one who decided to take this crazy English lady as a student, Roshi Kennett, who is in the picture to the right. And that's a picture of her when she was fairly young and freshly ordained. And so she's my Dharma grandmother, the teacher of my teachers. And then over to the left is Kyogen. So he was one of my teachers. My ordination teacher is Gyokoko, his wife. So the two of them founded and ran Dharmarain Zen Center for many, many years. And so he passed away in, I think, 2014, and just, you know, just way too soon, just as from a heart attack. And, you know, just one of those people you just think, oh, they should still be here. And then further to the left, this is Blanche Hartman, who isn't in my lineage, but, you know, is one of my heart connector teachers. She died a couple of years ago, and she was a senior teacher down at San Francisco Zen Center. So any questions about that one?
Oh, yeah, I do have a question.
Yeah, come on.
Yeah, I do have a question. So is that room open to people, or what's status of it? Is it like a shrine, or is it
That's a good question.
Yeah.
So that room is open. But it's like, it is kind of weird because, like, you know, I get changed in my robes in there. But my general rule of thumb is like, if the door is closed, you know, then you might knock. Like, I might be talking to somebody, I might be changing, whatever. But if the door is open, you can come on in. Although, you know, I don't know, people are still like, should I come in? But the library's in there, and then that is where I would meet with people one-on-one, say if we have a retreat, and, you know, then we're gonna, during Zazen, we might meet Anything? All right, James, you can come on back.
Oh wait. Butsudan over.
Oh, yes. So there is a Butsudan. That's another Kanseon. Really beautiful, beautiful statue. Yeah. So we, I think she's got, yeah, so she's got that one. She has, she's got, there's some symbolism of the frond, like a piece of plant that she has. And then I think what is it, like wish fulfilling potion or something? I can't remember what she has in that jar, but sometimes you'll see statues where she's pouring the stuff out of the jar. I don't know, I have to check it out. All right, James, thank you. So,
you can spotlight now.
Yeah, if you wouldn't mind doing that, just it's under the little three little dots in the corner. So just a note about how to act around altars and perhaps how to set one up. Off speaker view?
No, I'm not speaker view.
It's on speaker view now, so.
Oh, that's okay. I was there for a second. That was a nervous thing. Okay.
All right. I gotta set mine back to gallery TV too. Okay. So many of you, I know, already have home altars. We shared pictures of them in the newsletter for a stretch there. It was really sweet. Basically, you know, any elevated spot, clean, not encroached on by other stuff, you know, so it's good if it's a shelf or a, you know, I even have one that's in a bookshelf, like it's a shelf on a bookshelf, so it's kind of enclosed. And you don't have to, some people like don't even want a statue. They just put, you know, a beautiful rock or something kind of inspiring like that. Or it could just be, it doesn't have to be a statue, it can also be an image in a frame or something like that. Something that reminds you of your aspiration, and then, you know, the classic components are the candle on the right and the flowers on the left, and you can have real flowers or fake. Like I said, I can't maintain real flowers, so I always have not dried but like, you know, silk flowers. Little incense burner. Usually it's great if the Buddha image, if it is a Buddha image, you could be on a slightly higher level than all the other stuff. So it's nice if he has a little stand or a little box that you put it on, so it's a little higher. And you know, when we are when we approach an altar, classically in the Zendo, when we cross in front of it or we approach it, we make a standing bow. And that's why in the dirt Zendo, when you're crossing from one side to the other, you end up, you're crossing in front of the main altar. So it's a mindfulness practice to remember as you're crossing to turn toward the main altar and make a little bow as you move across. And then of course, just trying to keep an altar clean. I have somebody who helps me clean, and I don't say anything to her because she's very, very helpful. But in my altar in my office, she'll like put the duster or something like that up on the altar while she's cleaning. And I'm just like, but I just let it go. But like, that's generally not right. You don't, and in the Zendo, you know, it's tempting sometimes, you got something in your hands or whatever, and you're just gonna like, oh, you just set that on the altar. But like, generally not. Not of a sign of respect. So I'll leave it there. So any questions, or feel free to make a comment about, you know, your relationship to altars or whatever. So-on.
Well, hello there. Long time no see, I know.
Yeah.
I've been crazy busy on every Sunday for a long time. I remember setting that altar up, the one in the church, when we're pulling everything out of big buckets, and then we have to stash it all and stack up all the Zafus and Zabatons, and that was pretty crazy. But I just have this visceral memory of that box and what it feels like, and how kind of flimsy that box is in a way, and how that Buddha statue feels, and laying things out. And so that's like real. It has this tangible reality to me as a memory. It's amazing. I can like feel it in my hands. It's really something. But I came up with this weird analogy a while ago about like our Bodhisattva's real with the Starship Enterprise. I've watched so much Star Trek over the years. And I'm a total Trekker and I love Star Trek. So it's like the Starship Enterprise. It's like, I can see it in my head. I can see the Jeffries tubes and the hallways and the bridge and the ready room. I can see it all in my, it's like, it's very real to me. And it brings me this really happy feeling. And so to me, it's like you said, it doesn't really matter. And so when I think of Kanzion and compassion and Samantabhadra, steadfastness, and it's just a feeling that I get, and they're real to me in the same way the Enterprise is real. It's kind of goofy, but that's kind of Kyogen. I'm one of Kyogen's disciples, so you know.
I have a question. The books in the library, and I have lots of Buddhist books and Zen books. What is the place of books and reading in Zen where we really don't, particularly like analysis and superficial descriptions?
Yeah. What you remind me of is, I think this was a teaching of my Dharma grandmother, Roshi Kennett, of like, there may be things that we shouldn't overindulge in, but if we have to avoid them, like the plague, we're also in a way controlled by them.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, like we engage in study trying to also maintain the consciousness that this is not it. This is the finger pointing at the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite way of thinking about Buddhist study and Zen study in particular is that it should never be about accruing more ideas. It should be about challenging the ideas that we already have.
Mm-hmm.
And we may be sitting there thinking like, you know, I'm not going to indulge in study because that's just intellectual analysis and stuff. But in some ways, then you could be sitting there with a whole lot of assumptions and ideas that you aren't even aware of. Like, it's really through that exposure. And that is not the only way. So I feel like in our lineage, it's like, it's not, you know, required, but it's considered very valuable for most of us. James in the Zendo.
I had to riff off something Lisa said that I thought would be pretty funny, that I've got a butsudan at home that my wife got for me, and I have a Buddha image in there, and you know, I've tried to set it up the right way, but it's in my studio / office / everything room, my man cave, if you will. And my kids have free access to the room. I also have a 5-year-old daughter. So one day I go sit down to do my zazen, and I, you know, light the candle, and I open the butsudan doors, and there's Buddha with Oscar the Grouch and Cookie Monster standing on either side. And my first thought was, oh, Anjali, what are you doing? And then I realized, oh, wait a minute, this is perfect. The Bodhisattva of
anger and a bodhisattva of greed. It's perfect. So I just left him in there for a couple of days.
Oh, that's so cute.
I know. Talking about the sanctity of altars.
She's like, obviously, this is where you put important characters.
Oh, yeah. She knows
I'll go,
better
I'll
than
go
I
get
do.
Some yeah. important characters. Put them in the altar. Yeah, that reminds me of the also the when you're sharing the Dharma with children, particularly little children, one of the most popular and effective little things is a ritual of setting up an altar, like each time that you meet. So at Dharma Rain, they would have this basket of little animals, little Buddha statues, little flowers and shells and whatever. And then, you know, they clear up and put out the nice cloth. And then they'd each take turns putting something on the altar and making this pretty altar. And then at the end, they would take it all back down. Paulette?
You were talking earlier about people that think that the Buddhas are real. So, I mean, for me, I feel like they're an essence, not necessarily actual people, but I do find that when I ask Green Tara for help, I do get a pretty quick response. Mm. So it's a wonderful, like, confirmation of that for me.
Well, and people have asked me before, like, you know, we have a part in our morning chant where we dedicate the merit of our practice and then we recite the names of people who are ill or in difficulty or who have died. And, you know, it's kind of like, well, who are we sending that prayer to, you know, like, or, you know, and so I think so I may have given the wrong impression in saying that I just think it's all symbol, but I guess I would say the better description is that I am wholeheartedly agnostic about this stuff, right? It's like, I don't know, and I'm not inclined to believe unless I have some pretty concrete personal experience. And yet the world is just, I'm not gonna claim that I have a handle on how things work. There is a sense, like, even just thinking of the, you know, the founder's altar where we have the pictures of these people, and, you know, that sense that people aren't really gone even though they're gone, and in what sense do they continue with us? And I suspect that there's a whole lot more going on than we're consciously aware of at this point. Well, now we're at 12:15, so hopefully that demystified altars a little bit for you. Close. Oh, Yeshe, Tsoki.
I was just thinking that just as we're emptiness, I don't know if that's the way to word it, I have the sense that the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas are also emptiness, and that way, we're all eternal, and yet we're impermanent.
That's a nice note to end on. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha, prajna, Paramita.